This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. This is what most people come to Antalya for: beach, sun, and not much else. And that's fine. But head inland just a little and you can experience a different kind of Antalya. At Köprülü Canyon National Park, one of Türkiye's most accessible places for adventure sports and personal favorite spot of local guide Berfin Özçelik.
You can spend your whole day here. First, you should go to the canyon to do rafting. But there is so much more than that.
Yes, it's not just adrenaline that's to be found in these hills. High above the river, the pillars of Adam Rock surround the ruins of Selge, an ancient city that's been here far longer than the rafting routes.
Selge is like a gem waiting to be discovered.
So it's not exactly what you expected from a day in Antalya, but that's exactly the point. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumors, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
The world's biggest cliche is probably that the internet has proved to be a force for great good, and too often a force for great harm. Harm, particularly for the young and vulnerable. That's why the government is in the process of trying to pass an online safety bill to tackle harmful content. But what's in the bill? Will it actually work? And will it potentially create as many problems as it solves? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. To begin with, why was it thought we needed an online safety bill in the first place? Joshua Rosenberg is a legal commentator and presenter of Radio 4's Law in Action programme. Joshua Rosenberg, when was legislation to tackle online safety first proposed?
This goes back nearly 6 years. There was a green paper in October 2017 looking at the responsibilities of companies to keep users safe and prevent online harms. Then there was a white paper announced in May 2018. It was published in 2019. Then there was a government response in 2020. We got a draft online safety bill in 2021. That was looked at by joint committees, both Houses of Parliament. We then get the government's response in March 2022. And now finally we have a bill which is before Parliament.
Can you just remind us which governmental department is responsible for this?
This bill is the responsibility of the DCMS, the Department for Culture, Media and Sport. The idea is we're looking at information being presented to the public through the media, as it were, and so that's the responsibility of the Media and Culture Department.
If we cast our minds back, why was it felt back then that legislation was likely to be required?
There were concerns about the way in which the internet was affecting people, and there was a realisation that although there was some law, there was very little. There was the case of Molly Russell, who was the teenager from Harrow. She was found dead in her bedroom at around the time that the first green paper came out, shortly afterwards, in fact, November 2017. She had seen content relating to suicide, depression and anxiety online. Last September, a coroner ruled that she didn't die from suicide, but from an act of self-harm while suffering from depression and the negative effect of online content. Now, that case wasn't the spur for this legislation, but it certainly demonstrated the need in the view of the government.
Explain to me how the internet works when it comes to who's responsible for what content appears on it.
On the whole, the internet is unregulated because it's relatively new. There was law already. The criminal law applies to online activity in the same way as offline activity, and there are offences, communications offences. But much of the harmful online content doesn't cross the threshold of illegality.
One of the distinctions seems to be that big tech, the providers of these huge platforms which billions of people use, has not been subject to the same kind of rules as, say, publishers or even broadcasters like the BBC, which put out significantly less content. Does this proposed bill change that way of looking at things?
It certainly does. The Online Safety Bill will establish a new regulatory regime, if it's passed by Parliament, to address illegal and harmful content online. It imposes duties on three types of providers of internet services. People that allow users in the UK to share content that they generate themselves. We're talking here about companies like Facebook. Providers of search engines that are used in the UK. Obviously, Google is the best known of those. And also providers of internet services that display pornographic content that's not generated by users. These providers would have duties relating to illegal content, content that's harmful to children. If they're providing pornographic content, they'd have to prevent children from accessing that material, presumably through age verification. And at the same time, they would have to protect democratic debate and journalistic content. All this is going to be supervised by Ofcom, the Office of Communications. They would be the regulator, and they would have enforcement powers, including issuing fines of up to £18 million, or 10% of a company's worldwide revenue, whichever the higher, as well as powers to disrupt the business of a provider that was failing to comply with these requirements.
Now, Joshua, finally, does the fact that this bill has taken as long as you've told us it has to go from green paper to getting anywhere close to being an act, does that suggest that it's really a very complicated and difficult area?
It certainly is. Ultimately, governments are trying to balance competing interests. What is harmful content? Harmful content to some people is content which other people regard as an expression of free speech. Do you want to censor political content? Some people would say yes, many people would say no, free speech is essential. So these are difficult issues to get right. You are dealing with very powerful, very wealthy companies which have powerful lobbying abilities and are pushing, obviously, for a regulatory regime that they are comfortable with. So it is difficult, and even when the bill is published, that won't be the end of it. We've got to see how it beds in, and we've got to see how regulations work. We've got to see how it's developed by Ofcom.
Joshua Rosenberg, who will be back with Law in Action here on Radio 4 later this month. And of course, the podcast is on BBC Sounds now. Next, let's take a look at what is actually in the Online Safety Bill. Lorna Woods is Professor of Internet Law at the University of Essex. Lorna Woods, can you tell me about your involvement with the Online Safety Bill?
I had an idea back in about 2017 about how we might approach regulating social media without totally destroying the good stuff about it. I wrote this up for a blog on Carnegie UK Trust website and co-authored that with one of the trustees there, William Perrin. And as a result of that, we attracted the attention of the government, who asked us to come in and chat. And we were asked lots of difficult questions, which sent me away to do some more thinking. It seems that that sparked the germ of an idea in DCMS. And so the central idea from what we were saying, that is systemic regulation, that is regulating the platforms, not the content, and doing that through risk assessment and risk mitigation, formed the central idea in the Online Harms White Paper back in 2019.
How did you try and define what harm was?
We didn't go into a great deal of detail. And the reason for that is that if you are looking at a risk-based approach, you look at the thing that might be risky rather than the consequences and work back. So if you're doing a health and safety audit, you wouldn't think broken leg. How can broken legs be caused? What you would do is say, oh, there's some wires trailing across the floor. Somebody might trip over them. So the idea of harm needs to be less precisely delineated in that sort of model. Obviously, that wasn't the approach that the government ended up taking. They decided to identify categories of content that could be harmful.
So, Lorna, what kind of things is the bill going to cover?
The bill's covering two main categories. We've got content that's illegal and content that is harmful to children.
OK, so let's look at the content that's illegal. What kind of things are we talking about there?
We've got offences relating to terrorism. We've got offences relating to child sexual exploitation and abuse material. And then there's something called Schedule 7, which lists a selection of other offences that platforms will have specifically to deal with. So we've got threats to kill in there, assisting suicide, stalking and harassment. And then we've got other stuff that could include selling knives.
OK, and what about the stuff that isn't illegal but which is harmful?
Well, for adults, we have something called the Triple Shield. That is the rule saying we should try and minimise criminal content, that platforms should enforce their terms of service, and that for certain sorts of content, which the government's listed in the bill, big companies should provide user empowerment tools. And these are basically features that allow you a bit more control about what you see and also whether you engage with anonymous accounts.
OK, so that's the Triple Shield for adults, which may or may not amount to anything at all.
Correct.
So when we're talking about what the bill really is focusing in on, it's really focusing in on what children get to see and how they get to see it. Is that correct?
Yes. For children, we have the children's safety duties. And that, like the illegal content, will require platform operators to do a risk assessment, identify harmful stuff, and then take mitigating steps. Again, you've got a subset of content that the government's going to identify, and for that, there are stronger duties in play.
What kind of thing might be legal for adults but effectively made illegal for children?
Well, I think they've been talking about pornography as one priority content. Possibly some health misinformation may be going in there, but we haven't seen the list yet.
Now, what are the penalties which companies will face if they fail to act properly?
Well, Ofcom has an enforcement role. It can give them various sorts of notices, basically telling a company that there's an issue, how they can improve it. I think the intention is that Ofcom will work with companies rather than just come in heavy-handed. But at the tougher end, there are the possibilities of fines, but also something called business disruption measures, where Ofcom can go to court and get an order so that, say, internet service providers block access, or advertising companies or the credit card companies are told to not engage with the service.
So in other words, it would create a series of sanctions for specific platforms who failed to do what was required of them. But what you're saying is, in the first instance, Ofcom would say to them, look, you've got a problem here, you've got a period to sort it out, after which we will begin to take sanctions against you.
Yes, it seems to be a gradual process, trying to work with rather than impose a worldview from Ofcom from on top.
Now, my understanding of what you've said is that those things which are regarded as harmful but not illegal when it comes to adults no longer are covered in the bill. And you regard that as a significant weakening of your original proposal.
Yes. Well, there are some proposals regarding content that is effectively legal but still harmful. That's the user empowerment tools and requirements around enforcing terms of service. But my original thought was a bit more content blind, if you like. And what we were looking at was the way that the design of the platforms contributed or exacerbated problems. So in relation to content that was not contrary to the criminal law or contrary even to the civil law, the thought was, well, how about the platforms stop exacerbating things and try and make things a bit better, allow people to coexist more easily? So you do see some examples of this sort of thing with some of the design features that have come in over the last 5 or so years. Things like nudges on, do you really mean to post that? And user empowerment tools can be pretty useful in terms of you seeing what you want to see. So there are a whole range of measures to allow that sort of content to be there, but to be less problematic for people who don't want to see it.
Can we take a concrete example, which is the example of Twitter? When Elon Musk took over Twitter, the first thing he did, and a lot of people's perception, was to dismantle quite a lot of the internal restrictions on certain forms of posting which had been put in place. Is it your understanding that your approach to the bill would have meant, for example, that Twitter might very well have been forced to think again about removing those restrictions?
Yes. I mean, the idea would have been that a significant change should trigger a risk assessment and that you'd look at the likely consequences of that and then take steps to respond to likely risks, but then also to keep monitoring, not on an ongoing basis, but maybe snapshots of what's happening, how it's working, and to tweak as necessary. So yes, under my view, there would not have been as much freedom there.
Now, we heard from Joshua Rosenberg earlier that one of the cases that really helped propel the bill along in political terms was the Molly Russell case. And obviously, you'll have been very well aware of it. What is your understanding about what the bill would mean in practice for the problems which surrounded the Molly Russell case?
Well, it's a very interesting example to take when you're looking at the bill, because some people have questions as to how far the bill actually covers it. The government is pretty clear that it would do. So what we've got in this sort of case is individual items of content that on their own would not probably be a problem. But what's happened is that the system has personalised a feed, and having started to show an interest in that particular sort of content, you get more and possibly more extreme. So the question really is, does the bill just look at individual items of content, or does it look at the platform's role in curating, in promoting, in highlighting? Now, if you look at the definition of harm in the bill, it says you can take into account the fact of dissemination in assessing harm. So that says it could be caught. But for some of the children's safety duties, and Molly Russell was a child, it specifically excludes the fact of dissemination. Not for all of them, but for some of them. And some people are quite rightly worried about that.
In other words, the famous rabbit hole has not been closed.
Not 100%. We're maybe shovelling dirt down it.
Okay. Lorna, please stay with us. We've heard about why we are thought to need an online safety bill and what's in the one we've got. But is the one we've got actually going to work? Joining me in the briefing room now are Victoria Nash, Senior Policy Fellow at the Oxford Internet Institute, and Gina Neff, Executive Director of the Mindaroo Centre for Technology and Democracy at the University of Cambridge. Victoria, can I ask you first, does this bill in current form make sense, do you think, as a piece of legislation?
Yeah, I think Lorna's already explained it really well, is that her initial idea is really quite a simple, albeit quite ambitious, framework for legislation. And what we actually have now has simply become, I think, too big and too complex. You know, it's 250 pages. We've got 10 pages just of the contents alone. And I think we've lost that sort of simplicity and coherence of the original duty of care framework that Lorna and Will proposed. We effectively have now, I think, got some element to this systems-focused approach. But we've frankly also got a sort of laundry list of different offences and, you know, lots of very explicit mention of content risks as opposed to other sort of different broader types of risks. So no, I think unfortunately it doesn't really, you know, make sense as a piece of legislation as much as we originally would have hoped.
Gina, to what extent do you think this is possibly inevitable? I mean, there's so much content on the internet that any comparisons with traditional publishers and their responsibilities and even broadcasting outlets is redundant, because we're talking about billions of posts compared to, let's say, hundreds or maybe possibly in the low thousands of what conventional platforms would put out. How realistic is it that it could all be monitored, assessed and removed if required?
I think that's a great question. Earlier in the program, you suggested this model of caring about broken legs, right? Health and safety would care about if people have a broken leg. They would actually care about, are employers leaving ladders about? I think the framework that Lorna has been talking about and the spirit originally behind the bill was, do we have a mechanism for ensuring that there's a systematic approach that platforms are doing the job that they say they're doing for us, the users, the customers? And that's not impossible, but it is something that experience has proved that we need to legislate. We can't simply leave it to the platforms to do it on their own.
Victoria, to what extent do you think that there was always inherent in this, particularly if you made the penalties on companies severe, a danger of massive censorship on the part of the tech companies as they tried to avoid big fines by making their algorithms, right, drawing their algorithms really tightly?
Yeah, it's also a very good question. I think this concern about the potential chilling effects of legislation like this is nothing new. We've had that concern about any form of online regulation for quite some time. But I think actually I'm reasonably optimistic about this. If we look, for example, at experience in Germany, where companies like Facebook have already faced regulation in terms of, you know, how quickly they need to take certain types of content offline, quite a bit of the academic evidence seems to suggest that actually companies have been a bit more cautious in removing it quickly. What's different in this case is the fact that, as we've been setting out, this is supposed to be a systems-focused approach. So whether or not those systems will be dialed up, if you like, so tightly that actually they are quite conservative in keeping certain sorts of content off, that is potentially a bit more worrying. But yeah, I'm not quite as negative, I think, or as pessimistic about this as some others.
But Gina, let's look at the body that's tasked with enforcing this, which is Ofcom. Do you think that Ofcom is up to the job?
There's a lot of work that's going to be necessary to build capacity, both within the regulator, but also within across the UK, to ensure that we have the talent, the skills to handle this. But one of the pieces that I am optimistic about is the bill currently calls for Ofcom to lead a report on independent access to social media data so that we can assess the health of the online networks outside of taking the platform company's word on what's going on online. And what this bill gives a framework for is independent oversight of what's happening when that combination of algorithm, data, and user combine.
Victoria, can I just ask you about the companies that have been saying that the difficulty they will have in complying will mean that they may even stop offering services in the UK? I believe WhatsApp have said this. I think Wikipedia have said this.
That's quite right. So there are sort of two groups, if you like, that are particularly concerned about whether or not they'll be able to stay in the UK market. So one is the providers of encrypted messaging services, so WhatsApp, Signal, and some others. And the dilemma for them is that, you know, fundamentally what they're selling is secure messaging services. Now, if we introduce a piece of legislation in the UK, which is a very small market, I think it's just 2% of WhatsApp's customers, for example. And if that legislation requires those companies to either provide generalized monitoring of content, perhaps at device level, or to enable Ofcom to require particular encrypted services to be opened up on demand, then, you know, in both of those cases, it's not even necessarily that it's not technically possible. I suspect it's very difficult, but it's more that it undermines all trust in their service. It undermines the whole point of their product. So I think in the case of those companies, there's a real concern that they may well pull out, albeit, you know, at the moment, the argument is that Ofcom would only have to request these possibilities, not necessarily sort of built into the bill as a sort of fundamental requirement. But the second group, if, you know, just quickly also, is that there are some organizations like Wikipedia who have also suggested they may pull out. And it's simply that, you know, the very basic business model of Wikipedia as a sort of crowdsourced, non-profit making, you know, public value business is such that it, you know, probably couldn't afford to comply with the sorts of requirements that, that this bill may put in place. So yeah, there are some organizations who may indeed pull out.
Gina, do you make a differentiation between companies you think may very well have to pull out under these circumstances, or in the circumstance that Ofcom were actually to make that requirement consequent to the Act, and companies who say they will, but actually probably in the end won't?
I think the encryption debate takes us off the focus of what is the main thrust of this bill, which is at its core to be a systematic approach that requires companies to do that risk-based assessment of the health of their online communities, because we no longer can trust that the companies will do it for themselves. So if we go down the rabbit hole of the discussions of whether non-encryption can or will or will be compelled to be broken, you know, we're taking our eyes off the prize. The idea is that we want safer online environments for ourselves and our children, and we want to hold the companies to public account, democratic public account, to ensure that that happens.
Victoria, can I go straight to one of the major elements of the bill, in the structure of the bill, which is the distinction made between what it is that you can do when providing services that children use and that adults use. And of course, this must depend upon age verification, because otherwise it makes no sense. So how will sites in the future verify the age of users better than they are at the moment?
So it is interesting. I mean, I have spoken to, you know, some of the MPs and Lords, you know, taking this through Parliament at the moment. And actually, some of them deny that the bill will require age verification on the part of these companies. And I suppose they're relying on, you know, the alternative possibility, if you like, is that companies could choose not to age verify and simply offer as a default a service which, you know, if you like, would be family friendly or appropriate for all age groups. So I suppose it's worth saying that to start with. But for those that do want to offer the full range of services which would be accessible to adults, you know, we have to go beyond, I think, what currently is in place. So a lot of social media services currently rely on what we would call self-declaration, you know, that sort of tick box completion where, you know, you say you are over 13 or you enter an age which is then not checked. It has been interesting, though, that actually some of these companies have already been announcing they will take tougher measures. For example, I think Meta announced in perhaps back in 2021 that they would use AI to draw inferences from user behavior online or to compare information they might have across some of their different platforms. Another solution would be the one that YouTube uses, I think, in the EU, whereby if you want to access content or material which would be suitable for over 18s only, you have to be logged into an account and you have to provide it verified ID as part of that account setup.
I want to ask a final question. As we know, the bill began its life really in discussion in 2017. Just in the last year, and we've had a mention of AI there, the atmosphere around tech has changed entirely. So I want to ask you this quickly. Are we going to need a new bill to take into account the age of artificial intelligence within a year or two of this one being passed?
Thank you for asking the tough question. I think it depends how the bill is actually implemented and the approach, because on one level, AI is just a functionality. And so at a very simple level, you could say risk assess, risk mitigate. What that means in practice, obviously, whole different ball game.
Lorna Woods there with Gina Neff and Victoria Nash. My thanks to them and to Joshua Rosenberg. My conclusion, I can see the need for some regulation, as in the bill, but I can't help wondering whether, as technology changes so rapidly, the emphasis doesn't need to be on educating the user rather than seeking to penalise the platform. Just before we go, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including last week's on the latest on the war in Ukraine, the one about whether we should worry about the AI revolution, and in the wake of the news that TransPennine Express has lost its contract over poor rail service, listen to the one about how we fix Britain's railways. This is the last episode in the current series, but the Briefing Room will be back next month.
What could be more modern than a net zero travel show? A show about going places that never goes anywhere. Welcome then to Your Place or Mine on BBC Radio 4. I'm Sean Keaveney and I love travelling almost as much as I love staying at home and watching music documentaries.
I figure Massachusetts, you know, for somebody like you who doesn't particularly enjoy broadening their horizons, it would be sort of a baby step because Massachusetts is kind of the heart of New England. So, you know, it wouldn't be too shocking for you.
Each week, another fantastic and intrepid guest attempts to lull me out of my postcode with persuasion alone.
Eat the insects too. I mean, that's what they do a lot in Oaxaca. They normally roast them and then you can scatter them on your guacamole. There's something deliciously kind of earthy and umami about insects.
Anybody who's been on the back of my Uncle Paul's motorbike's eating a lot of insects, you know, because he goes very fast.
Your Place or Mine, with me, Sean Keaveney. Listen and subscribe on BBC Sounds.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day, and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.